Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. According to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, state prisons are operating at 10% beyond capacity. But even as we build new prisons, it's estimated that we will again be full or even overcrowded in 5 years' time if we continue on our current path. Some suggest it's time to take a look at other options, including restorative justice. We'll find out more about that. Let's take note with Tom Brewster. He is Executive Director of Centerpiece Incorporated, based in Bellefonte, Center County. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
What is Centerpiece?
Centerpiece is a nonprofit organization that is faith-based. We take a look at ways of reaching into prisons and changing for the better lives of those who are currently incarcerated.
There are currently 2.4 million people in prison throughout the United States. 600,000 of those inmates will be released back into society this year. Are most of them ready for reentry?
Absolutely not. Most do not realize that their lives have changed dramatically because of their time in prison. We, as a society, I believe, are not preparing them for that transition back into their communities, even back into their own families.
One of the things that you do at Centerpiece, and something that lots of people in Center County are familiar with, is your storefront in Bellefonte. You call this Project Restore. Tell us a little bit about what goes on there. And for those who don't know, this is not just an ordinary thrift shop.
And that's a good point, because what we do in our thrift shop, we provide used furniture and household goods to the community at large. We do that only because we want to generate revenue for our Project Restore program. And that's a program where we bring inmates from the Center County Correctional Facility to our facility each and every day. When they are at Centerpiece, we provide them with vocational skills, we provide them with interpersonal skills training, and we make them accountable for what they have done wrong.
There's some 2,100 inmates at Rockview. About half of them are currently enrolled in some kind of an educational program, most of them working on GEDs and getting some of the vocational training that you're talking about. That can be a hard sell, though, because lots of people think, why are we spending money to educate or provide vocational training to what they might consider the least deserving citizens?
Sure. But if we look at it from another perspective, Patty, if we don't provide them with that training, we will see them once again come into the system. And at $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000 per year to incarcerate a single individual, it's in the society's best interest to make sure that these individuals are, in fact, well prepared when they return to their communities.
Who's eligible to participate in the Restore Project?
We abide by the guidelines of the Center County Correctional Facility. They have to be nonviolent offenders. They can't be accused of any kind of sex crime, any kind of crimes against children, no abuse. So these are our neighbors, in essence, who have made a bad choice. That it may be alcohol-related, it may be drug-related, and we're not saying that they shouldn't be accountable. We're saying that we want them to begin to give back to the community from which they've taken.
One of the slogans, and something anyone who's been in the store will see, are signs that say, restoring furniture, restoring lives. How does that work? What kinds of transitions or transformations do you see among the people who participate in that program?
When an individual enters the criminal justice system as an inmate, they are, in essence, looked upon as a second-class citizen. When they arrive at Centerpiece, we tell them right up front that we care about them, we love them, we are not judging them, but we are holding them accountable. And as long as they show respect to us, we will show respect to them. And for many, quite frankly, this is the first time that someone has ever looked in their eyes and told them that they were cared about.
You say that restoring an inmate's sense of dignity is critical to the transition. Explain.
Again, when someone enters the criminal justice system, they are looked down upon in almost every way. So if we expect them to be successful once they re-enter society, we all need that sense of self-respect, that sense of self-esteem. We all need support around us. And so that's what we're aiming to provide these inmates when they are at Centerpiece.
That's something that those on the receiving end, victims of crime, need as well.
Absolutely. That's another, I think, error in the current criminal justice system. We do not involve the victims. We do not involve the families of the victim or of the perpetrator. There are more people hurting because of a single crime than just the victim. We've got an entire system around them that also hurts.
I watched a video of what goes on at Centerpiece in terms of restoring furniture. There are inmates who are learning how to cane and refinish furniture, reupholster furniture. But there's more to the story than that, and that's the voucher program. So we're talking about a program that's win-win in so many ways. Tell us about the voucher program.
Absolutely. We are excited that this program has taken off like it has. Basically, in a nutshell, the program is a collaboration with all of the other social service agencies in the center region, like the Women's Resource Center, St. Vincent de Paul, Catholic Social Services. When those organizations receive a client because of some disaster, they may have been burned out of their house, a woman may have left an abusive relationship, they will provide that individual or those individuals with a voucher to come to Centerpiece and purchase as much furniture and household goods as they need to start over. They get that all of those items for free. We bill back the other agency 50%. Centerpiece absorbs the other 50%. In 2007 alone, we gave away nearly $20,000 worth of used furniture and household goods.
Recidivism rates are something that people look at to judge just how effective our criminal justice system is. Do you have any statistics, or how do you measure the success of Centerpiece and those who are enrolled in that program?
It's very difficult to measure recidivism. And nationally, the numbers range anywhere from 50% to 65% of all of those individuals released will reoffend. We feel anecdotally that those individuals who come through the programs at Centerpiece have a much greater chance of receiving the kind of support that they will need, the emotional support, the financial support that they will need once they are released. It's very difficult for empirical data because this is a very transient population. So it's sometimes difficult to track people. And certainly this is a time in their lives that they would like to forget. So they're not always willing to provide any information once they have left the criminal justice system.
You gave up a lucrative career in international business. You were involved in new business development overseas. What was your first encounter with Centerpiece, and what was it about what's going on there that so drew you that you really changed careers?
I was in international business for a number of years, and the reason I liked doing business in Southeast Asia was because of the development of relationships with people. When my wife and I returned to State College so that I could pursue a graduate degree, I wanted to provide some kind of community service, ran into the then executive director of Centerpiece, Marie Hamilton, and she asked if I would be willing to be trained as a facilitator on the special needs unit at Rockview. Once I walked on the block at Rockview, I knew that I was home. There was a peace about me that I've never felt before.
You mentioned a special needs unit, which will probably open a lot of people's eyes to some of the people who were there. You were dealing with people who really had mental illnesses that were, in large part, what landed them in prison in the first place.
Absolutely. Of the 2,100 individuals currently at Rockview, there are about 90 men on the special needs unit. These are men who are under some kind of clinical care. They are all taking some kind of psychotropic medication, anything from clinical depression to full-blown paranoid schizophrenia. These are individuals who at one point probably were in or should have been in a mental hospital.
How do you make the case for Centerpiece for those who don't really know what you're doing, or who think, again, that we're throwing money at the wrong population?
We consider what we do a ministry. There are a number of churches in the community who have wonderful outreach programs all over the world. What we're asking them to do is to look in our backyard and not overlook the 2,100-plus individuals who, in fact, need desperately caring.
And, in fact, they'll be our neighbors at one point.
Absolutely. So it's in our best interest to make certain that they are prepared to come home.
One of the things you're interested in doing as executive director is expanding Centerpiece's program to include inmate housing. Now, there are programs similar to, I think, what you want to do in places like Williamsport, Pennsylvania, where they have transitional living centers. But even when they're very, very effective, and there are stats to prove that the recidivism rates are very low among those who go through the program, there's tremendous resistance in communities that are afraid of having this kind of a facility in their backyard.
That's a valid, legitimate argument for those who might have some experience living near one of these facilities. But I would argue that wouldn't it be a much more dangerous situation if we send these individuals out either homeless without any kind of direction? And I would say that they will have a much larger chance of being successful if they are under some kind of supervised care.
There is one gentleman that you worked with, a former prisoner who went through Centerpiece and now wants to open Centerpiece West. My guess is you include him as one of your success stories. Is there someone, maybe him, who stands out as, this is what it's all about, this is why we do what we do here?
Sure. And sometimes it's difficult at Centerpiece to know when we are or are not successful, because some of the things that we do at Centerpiece may impact an individual long after they have departed us. In this one particular case, it was an individual who spent several months at Centerpiece and was so taken by the care that we took of him once he was released and returned to his home in Tucson, Arizona, he began investigating the possibilities of being able to open a Centerpiece West.
Centerpiece has been around in one form or another for nearly 30 years now. What do you see as the future for this kind of a program, and is there much public support for these kinds of things?
There is not much public support, but the support is growing. I think one of my challenges, one of my goals, is to make the public aware of what it is exactly that we are doing over and above selling used furniture and household goods. My vision for Centerpiece is to provide the kind of preparation to these individuals when they are released so that they are, in fact, successful.
Tom Brewster is executive director of Centerpiece Incorporated, based in Bellefonte, Center County. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Growing up poor in the country is very different from growing up poor in the city, yet most studies of how poverty affects children have been carried out in urban areas. Now, the National Institutes of Health has funded a major study of disadvantaged children in rural areas, including central Pennsylvania. Take Note, Cynthia Berger talks with Penn State's Mark Greenberg, one of the researchers who heads up the project.
We're here to talk about the Family Life Project. You're one of the principal investigators for the program. You're looking at how poverty affects child development. And let's start with what I thought was a striking bit of information from your website. We think of America as highly urbanized, and when we think of cities, we think of urban decay. But as I understand it, if you actually look at the numbers, more than half of all poor children live in rural areas. Is that right?
That's right. And it's surprising to most people that most people think of poverty as mostly an urban phenomenon. But in fact, it turns out that nearly half of all children in America that are poor live in rural settings, in areas that are outside urban areas.
And the other statistic that I found striking was that there are more children who are extremely poor in rural areas compared to urban areas.
That's right. And another surprising finding, even to myself, and that is that when we look only at children that are poor, and we only look at that category of children in America, and we compare urban and rural children, we find that rural children are more poor. That is, their families have less dollars per family member to spend on their development.
Now, this is going to come as no surprise to people in Pennsylvania who follow the news, but rural areas are facing some particular challenges economically in terms of job loss, what you might call the brain drain.
That's right. And what we're seeing, of course, is true at all throughout the United States. And Pennsylvania has the same situation, that as fewer good jobs remain in rural areas and small towns, young people go away to college or to vocational schools, and they often don't return back to their communities. And in the long run, that saps the resources of a community.
So that takes us around to the reason for your study. Up until now, educators and sociologists, when they study poor children, they've focused mostly on the urban poor.
That's right. And so the goal of this study is really to understand how family life and the supports around families and children's own characteristics predict how well rural children do in the United States. We know a lot about urban children. We know a lot about the effects of things like urban neighborhood violence or living in crowded conditions in cities. But we don't know what risk factors are mostly influencing the development of rural children.
Why do you suppose it is that the rural poor have been overlooked like this?
Well, I think it's not been as much of a state or a federal priority, that we're mostly interested in studying things that have the highest risks. And because we know about the high rates of urban school dropout, of urban crime, of urban drug use, that priority has really been placed there in understanding how children develop. But, you know, it turns out that here's another myth, and that is that people assume that that drug use is higher in urban than in rural areas. But it turns out that that's not true, that children, young teens, start drinking alcohol and smoking at about the same time or a little bit earlier in rural areas. And rural drug rates in Pennsylvania for alcohol, cigarettes, and marijuana are very similar to the rates in inner cities in Pennsylvania.
How about that? Well, your project, the Family Life Project, was launched 5 years ago in 2002. With $16.5 million in funding from the National Institutes of Health. So that's quite a significant initiative. The largest, most comprehensive, most representative study to date of children's development in rural America. And we should say this is quite a large team of researchers involved. Give us the extent of the project.
Right. Well, there are 23 investigators involved in the project here at Penn State and North Carolina, where Lynn Vernon Fagans, my colleague, is the director. And we have a lot of goals in this project. We talk about it as a project that goes all the way from neurons to neighborhoods. So we're studying children not only in terms of their family life and the quality of the interactions they have with their parents and as they get older with their teachers. We're interested in marital life and in the family. We're interested in family supports and stresses. We're interested in the kinds of jobs families have. We're interested in the kind of neighborhoods they live in, but we're also interested in things that are inside the child, that is the child's own physiological development as well as their genetic makeup.
Wow, that's a lot of different things to keep track of. This is a two-phase study, and I want to talk first about the very beginning. Starting in September 2003, you identified about 1,000 children that you've been studying starting from the day they were born. And you picked children from two different rural areas. So let's talk about the geography. Tell us about the two different locations you're studying.
Right. So we picked two places that we think represent sort of rural families in the eastern United States, at least. And that is in Pennsylvania, we picked three communities that are just to the west of State College, which are the counties of Cambria, Blair, and Huntington counties. And those are counties that we think represent what you might call northern Appalachian life. They're relatively small communities for the most part, although there are two larger towns, Johnstown and Altoona. And similarly, we picked three counties in eastern North Carolina that represent what we call the Black South, or rural life for families in the South. And we picked counties that particularly had a high rate of African-American rural families. And in these communities, about 40% of all families are rural and African-American.
Tell us just a little bit more about the Pennsylvania communities. You mentioned Johnstown and Altoona. What are some of the other communities that have families involved in the study?
Well, there are families living, of course, in really rural areas, but towns like Evansburg and Tyrone and Mount Union are examples of towns, smaller towns in these counties. And I must say that both the community structure, those politicians and key leaders, social service agencies, the education community, hospitals, they've all been very excited about this project because we all need to learn more about what the needs are of rural children in order to develop better services for them.
And when we say you're looking at poor families, what's a typical income for a family participating in the study?
Well, we're actually looking at all families in the communities. We're looking at families that range from those that are quite poor to those that are middle class. About a third to a half of our families have college degrees, although we oversampled families that were poor because we especially want to understand what the effects of rural poverty are. So we have families that are really living hand-to-mouth, if you will, in which they don't have enough money to really pay their rent, don't have a car, are having a hard time getting a job because they don't have transportation. They face an enormous number of obstacles to develop a stable family life.
How did you choose which families would be in the study, and how did you get them to participate? Are families paid to be in the study? Is there any incentive?
Well, we recruited the families when they were in the hospital, when the mother was giving birth. And within about a day or so of the birth, we would talk to her about her desire. And we had very high participation. I think about 80% of families that we approached in all the hospitals in the counties agreed. And then we took that sample and we had some statistical analysis done to pick families that represented, as well as possible, the census representation of families in these communities. And then when we went back to the families and said, well, you've been chosen, almost universally families said yes. And they've been incredible. They've been very open with us. We visit them really quite regularly, sometimes even for 2 or 3 hour visits twice in a week. And they are compensated for their time, but it's really not the reason that families participate in the project.
Well, that leads me to, I wanted to ask you more about exactly how you collect information and what kinds of information. And you mentioned home visits. When you visit families at home, tell us more about what you're doing. I guess one step is that sometimes you do some videotaping to see how parents interact with their children.
Right. So we videotape family interactions that are there, maybe between the husband and the wife, where they are discussing issues that may be difficult and also easy for them. We also videotape the parent with the baby. Remember, we start quite early at 6 months of age. And so at 6 and 15 and 24 months, we videotape the mother and the baby, and we're interested in how the baby's behaving, how the mother's sensitivity and warmth links to the baby's behavior, how babies are beginning to develop language. Language is so important to everything that will happen in the rest of their lives. And so we're very interested in the kind of language input that mothers give, how much they talk to their babies, how they talk to them, what kind of vocabulary, under what conditions. But then we also study the baby themselves, and we study their heart rate. We try to assess their early cognitive abilities with a whole variety of what we would call games, but you might call them tests.
Mm-hmm. So what sorts of things are you learning from that?
Well, we're interested in babies in children's early language development and their early self-control. These are two very important things. Kids that have good early language development and have good self-control are likely to be on the path to school readiness. And one of the important things we've found is that that while poverty has an influence, even more important in some ways is what we call family chaos. So we look at an idea we call family disorganization, and that has to do with how clean the house is, how many hours per day the television is on, the number of people in the household, how crowded it is, the conditions of the neighborhood around the house, and how noisy it is. And what we find is that while poverty has effects on things like language development and self-control, how children can manage themselves, it's almost all the result of family disorganization. So if there are families who are poor but very organized, and their children do not suffer from the effects of poverty in the same way. They don't show delays in language and self-regulation, self-control. And as any parent will tell you, the most important things they're concerned about with their child when they're about 2 years of age is that they're able to communicate better with them, and they're able to have them regulate themselves so they're not in temper tantrums most of the time.
I guess one other thing that you've found, particularly in rural areas, that often there's a lot of long-distance travel for people who live far out, and that can be a factor in family dynamics.
That's right. We do what we call geographic information on each family to get a sense of how far they need to go to cash a check, to visit a doctor, to take their children to childcare, to be employed, et cetera. And what we find is that rural families often are really have enormous distances they must travel, and often with very poor transportation opportunities. This is one of the important things we are finding from this study, is a lack of transportation infrastructure for young families. And especially when you're working shifts, we find many, many of our parents are doing shift work, often at irregular hours where there's no child care available. That transportation issues and the amount of traveling they're doing is really part of what stresses their family lifestyles.
So that was the first phase of your study and some preliminary findings. This past January, you received another $12.8 million from the National Institutes of Health for the second phase of the study. The children are starting school. So what sorts of questions are you asking now?
Well, we're interested in school readiness, and we think about that in two ways. One is, are children getting ready for school? Do they have the skills they need, both social, emotionally, and academically, to begin to be successful in kindergarten? But we're also interested in, are schools ready for children? And that is, what kinds of classroom quality do children go into in rural America, and how does the quality of those classrooms affect their early learning? And so we're interested in the combination, the synchrony between a child's developing skills and the quality of the classroom environment they're going to enter.
So you have funding for another 5 years. I understand your goal, if you can obtain the funding, is to track children into adulthood.
That's right. We think of this as one of the important landmark studies of American life. And we're not interested just in children, but in their families and their communities. And we're interested in how early childhood not only affects learning and academic outcomes and staying in school through graduation, but we're interested in health and how that we see the development of medical risks that are related to stressful environments like diabetes and other immunological diseases. And so when I say this is a Neurons the Neighborhood study, we really mean it. We're interested in all the holistic aspect of not only children, but their families, their communities. And as we study this across many years, we'll have a very good feel for what it is that we can do to improve the life of families in these communities.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating project, and I'm sure educators will be watching for the results with interest. We've been talking with Mark Greenberg of Penn State University Park. He's with the Family Life Project, which studies how poverty affects the development of young children, focusing on families in North Carolina and right here in central Pennsylvania. Mark, thanks for joining us, and good luck with your ongoing work.
Great, thank you.
For Take Note, I'm Cynthia Berger.